The earliest form of nature writing is the myth. Successors to the early storytellers have included Dame Juliana Burns, the abbess who wrote a guide to trout fishing that was later cribbed by Isaac Walton as The Complete Angler. In the past century, Emerson, Muir, Isley, and Hegg Brown honed the nature essay form. It's a form that's attracted many writers and readers as a means of getting back to nature, if you will. California writer David Raines Wallace also ruminates about the out-of-doors. His books include The Klamath Knot, a collection of essays, and The Turquoise Dragon, a thriller involving kidnapped endangered species. His latest book, Bulow Hammock, is his reflection on his return to a swampland in Florida he explored as a boy. I ask Wallace what inspired him to write about the out-of-doors.
I've always been interested in nature. I grew up in Connecticut, in a rural area for the first from about ages 3 to 5, and somehow acquired a kind of a magical view of nature that I didn't get much chance to sort of exercise after my family moved to the suburbs, but it was always sort of there underneath, and I think the main influence that got me started writing was coming to the West Coast. I'd never really encountered wilderness before, as we have it here. Growing up in New England, there's a lot of little second growth trees, but you don't have the great redwoods and pines and large wilderness areas that you do here. So that was a revelation to me. It was a revelation to be able to row out in Tamales Bay and off Point Reyes and see herds of sea lions and harbor seals.
One of the reactions that people from the East have to going to California is the perceived lack of seasons, which, of course, if you live in California, you know is just not the case at all. There are very distinct seasons. But many people see it as kind of a year-round summertime. What was your reaction as an East Coast person to the climate changes that you saw between East and West of this continent?
Well, of course, the dryness is the main thing, and I think that I found that fascinating. In New England, everything is either covered with snow or covered with green leaves, and I found the wide open spaces of the West very inviting. You have a feeling of great space, of being able to move out into a very adventurous, interesting experiences that you don't have so much in the East. It's more of kind of a closed-in feeling there. So I think that aspect of it is very important. I miss thunderstorms and other aspects of the East, which is one reason I wrote this book, Bulow Hammock. It was sort of a return to Eastern roots in a way for me after the experience of the Western wilderness, a kind of a plugging back into of the experiences I'd had in the Western wilderness, back into the kind of places I'd grown up with as a child.
Bulow Hammock is a place in Florida,
yes.
Very swampy, filled with creatures that you'd otherwise not see in the West.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I went back was that, you know, as I said, I'd spent a lot of time in the wilderness out here in the West, and had had a very positive attitude toward it. I had the idea, as many people do, that I was sort of escaping from the anxieties of civilization by going out into these great wilderness areas and writing about them. My idea was simply to go out and experience these areas and enjoy them, write about them, and thereby try to help to encourage people to protect them. Somewhere along the way, I ran into a problem in that I started having anxiety attacks in the middle of the wilderness, which was a surprise to me. I began to wonder about my mind. We kind of take our minds for granted in a way. We assume that they're like a computer, a bunch of circuits that we program with experiences and information, and then that programming will help us to do what we want. But increasingly, the evidence of science is that the mind is not so much a computer as a program, and that is that it's not a blank slate of circuits that you just fill up with your own experiences. It's full of a lot of innate programming that goes back to a very old. The mind is an evolutionary phenomenon rather than a technological one. So, the mind is a kind of a paradigm of evolution in a way, in that it's the lowest part of the human mind is a mind that we share with reptiles and other animals, and then as different layers build up on the mind, you start getting consciousness closer to the human, to the more conscious primate consciousness. So it gave me second thoughts about, you know, what I was doing out there in the wilderness. I think Bilo Hammock, as a book, is an inquiry into the relationship between the mind and nature. And when I had started having these anxiety attacks in wilderness, it's kind of it's very anxious to have an anxiety attack in a wilderness area when you're 2 miles from the nearest, two days walk from the nearest roadhead, and you're spending a night in this kind of a terrified condition, which is not rational. You know, there wasn't any reason for me to be afraid, but I was anyway. So, I thought it would be interesting and maybe helpful to go back into the mind and into wild nature, into my own experience of wild nature, and into sort of an earlier time. I thought that this swamp, which I'd experienced as a small child when I was 9, and had felt some fear of at that time. When I was a child, I wasn't really afraid of nature, but that particular place seemed wilder and more complicated and stranger, in a way more savage than any other place I'd experienced growing up in New England. You know, it was like with full of alligators and poisonous snakes.
Was this what provoked your anxiety attacks?
I don't know what provoked my anxiety attacks. I suspect that one of the things that may prompt the feelings of anxiety that civilized people have is a kind of fear of getting lost. You know, we've come so far from our origins, from our evolution, with our great cities and all our cultural complication that we've got, that sometimes I think we have a feeling that we're kind of lost in space.
There's a section of Bilo Hammock that I'd like us to hear.
This is when I was just beginning to venture in, when I was first started visiting the hammock in the early 1980s. Although it was fall, the hammock was full of mosquitoes and ticks, and chiggers, as I realized later when their bites started itching. There were vast numbers of orb weaver spiders, at least one to every bush. I kept walking into the webs and into the spiders, huge yellow ones, 6 inches across with hairy legs, pink and green ones that looked like flower buds, gold and white ones with spine-covered abdomens. One of the huge ones, called a golden web spider, had caught a young anole lizard in its web, had wrapped it in silk, and was eating the flesh of the head. The lizard's white skull gleamed strangely from the gray web.
When you see a sight such as that, does it lock into your vision so that you're able to set it down later? Or do you take notes on it as you see it? Or does it haunt you at night as an image?
Well, it locks in pretty well, a sight like that. You don't see sights like that very often in nature. Predation predation like that it doesn't happen all the time. Of course, it does happen all the time, but you just don't see it that much. So seeing a lizard a spider eat a lizard is a very unusual sight. So I remembered that very well. I didn't have to take any notes of that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any bad dreams about it. I tend to have bad dreams about people, not animals.
One of your essays makes an observation about the nature of animal sounds that we hear in soundtracks on television and movies, that it becomes mm-hmm. kind of a generic nature sound, like the sound of the wren tit is the only bird sound we ever hear in movies, or the kookaburra in eerie jungle scene.
The kookaburra is a kind of kingfisher that lives in fairly dry eucalyptus woodland in Australia, so it's... when you're actually in the jungle, like in South Central America, you know, where I've been, you don't hear that at all. You hear things like tinamous, which are these little sort of chicken-like birds that have this beautiful kind of eerie whistling sound that they make. It's sort of it sounds like Rima the Bird Girl or something. It's not at all the kind of savage sound that you would expect in a jungle movie. It's something much more lovely and delicate, and most of the things in jungles are rather lovely and delicate.
How do you react to this kind of generic ecosystem that's put out in films and television?
Well, it's interesting. It makes watching television interesting because you can it's just funny to listen to a wren tit song, which a wren tit is a as a bird that's endemic to California chaparral. It doesn't live anywhere else. But you can hear it in movies about, like, the Scottish Highlands, or there's a lot of Wren Tit songs in the old Flash Gordon movies about the planet Mongo, Ming of Mongo, you know, that, all that stuff. And you'll, you know, you'll be, there'll be these giant scorpions running around, and then you'll hear a Wren Tit singing in the background. I mean, it's funny. But it also shows how lost, again, to get back to that metaphor, our civilization is in terms of natural ecosystems. I mean, people just have no idea sort of where they are in real ecological terms.
Thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me.